Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. Coming up, Russian court charges four men with acts of terrorism as the country is mourning the death from a deadly concert attack. China vows to treat foreign companies equally amid its industrial upgrade push. U.S. call for Gaza ceasefire runs into Russia-China veto at the UN. South Korea doctor strike widens as medical professors join the protests. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on our previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Russia has charged four men with committing an act of terrorism for an attack on a Moscow concert hall. Russian authorities say the four suspects were arrested on Saturday in the Bryansk region, some 400 kilometers southwest of the city of Moscow. Russian news agency TASS reported that the four people were identified as citizens of Tajikistan. All of them will be held in pretrial detention until at least May the 22nd. Friday saw the largest ever attack on Russian soil in more than a decade. Jihadist group ISIS has claimed the responsibility for the incident. However, Russian officials suggest that the attackers were also somehow helped by Ukraine, a claim that has been rejected by Kiev. So joining us now on the line is Professor Cui Hongjian from the Academy of Regional and Global Governance, Beijing Foreign Studies University. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor.
Hi.
So basically, what we see at the moment is that different sides have different claims regarding who is on earth responsible for the attack on last Friday. So in your analysis, what are some of the details in the Friday attack that you think might be somehow helpful to finding the real culprit?
So far, as we know, regarding to these terrorist attacks, so far we find out a very different views, different stance from every stakeholders, including Russia, Ukraine, and some even ISIS. And as we know that, indeed, in the background of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, so I think partly this incident had been used by some sides to, deal with some maybe more emerging issues. Also, we know from Russia's stance, undoubtedly, the first response from Russia is to aim at Ukraine and especially in the background of the tensions, more and more tensions in the battlefield in Ukraine. So I think it could be a reason for Russia to escalate the tensions and to increase its attack in Ukraine. Mm. But of course, I think from Ukraine, it's a very bad thing when something happened, especially with the name of a terrorist attack. As we know so far, the terrorism still the common threat for the human society. So I think, yes, there are some unknown details, and even at the same time, some sides try to take it use for their own purpose.
Mm. So by the way, Professor Cui, do you think this very idea that the Afghan branch of the ISIS or ISIS-K is responsible for the attack on Friday is a logical statement or idea?
Yes, I think it's also another unknown, reasons for this ISIS-K to claim the incident as the, its own job. As we know, usually for this terrorist attack, as we know for the terrorists, they try to have some more visibility by attacking, average people and to, popularize the influence. Even as we know, the ISIS-K, they try to get some more support from peoples, and they want to get some more even financial support from somebody. So they do have these reasons to claim this incident. But as we know, so far, it looks like the Russian side refuses to accept these claims from ISIS-K. I think that's the reason why once something happens in that way, it will give some more pressure on Russia to deal with some more internal terrorism pressure. So I think it's out of the interest of Russian government.
Yeah. So on Sunday, actually, Russia, we understand, staged some major airstrikes targeting the Ukrainian targets, like critical Ukrainian infrastructure networks, with one missile even entering the Polish airspace. So do you see any correlation, especially direct link, between this wave of Russian airstrikes and this Moscow concert hall attack?
To a large degree, I think they do have the links between this terrorist attack in Moscow and the, as I mentioned, that higher and higher attack from Moscow on Kyiv. As we know, especially recently, the message from Moscow, from Kremlin Palace, that now perhaps Russia is trying to define the nature of this so-called special military operation in Ukraine and change it into a war between Russia and Ukraine. So I think that it's in the same line for Moscow to have some more attention on Ukraine. But of course, not only because of the situation in battlefield, and largely because of the whole situation, especially between Russia and NATO, on some more and more confrontation, and even as we know now, NATO is holding a military practice access surrounding the Russia. So I think it's also a kind of deterrence. A message of deterrence from Moscow towards not only Ukraine and also towards NATO.
Especially the accession of Finland and Sweden into NATO military alliance is somewhat somehow making Russia more cornered, especially from maritime directions, etc., etc. So, by the way, Professor Cui, do you think we're likely to see a scenario in which it will never be absolutely clear regarding who was responsible for the attack on Friday in Moscow, which we know is something similar to what has happened after this Nord Stream pipeline blast?
Yes, as we know, the background is a Ukraine-Russia conflict. So it's in a very, very specific time. So there will not be some conditions necessary to help any investigation and to help any kind of open and clear, claims from every side. So just like I mentioned, that even before we get some more details, every side is trying to take use of it. I think now it looks like because the terrorism attack happened in Moscow, in Russia, so now Russia is trying to take some more advantage from this as a victim of a terrorism attack. So it will give some more reasons, or maybe legal reasons, for Russia to have some more attacks in Ukraine. Once it tried to find some more link between Ukraine and this terrorism attack. So I think, it's also some suspicion or worry from the Western countries, just like the higher rank officials from the UK mentioned that Russia should not take use of this terrorism attack and to finish its purpose in Ukraine and some other. So it's difficult because there will not be space, there will not be conditions to help the investigation and to get some more real truth for this attack.
So the final question before we let you go, Professor Cui, to what degree do you think Friday's attack in Moscow should raise security concern or security alert for some of the nearby or regional countries like in Central Asia or even China?
I think it depends on the final conclusion about this attack in Moscow. Once just the SSK claims that it's own job and NATO will do something more in this region, certainly I think they will give some more warning to some regional countries. As we know, now everybody is looking at the so-called bigger power gaming, but we should not forget, still, the terrorists still a very, very big threat to the human society. So not only for Russia and also not only for regional countries, especially in the platform of SCO or some other regional cooperation, we need to get some more attention to this potential terrorism threat.
Okay, your point's well taken. But thank you very much for joining us. That was Professor Cui Hongjian joining us from the Academy of Regional and Global Governance, Beijing Foreign Studies University. You are listening to World Today. Stay tuned.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombievsky Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy and management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Chinese Premier Li Qiang has reassured global business leaders about China's economy as well as the country's steadfast opening up. He said at the opening of the China Development Forum in Beijing that China's economy has strong resilience, vast potential, and sufficient vitalities, and an increasingly open China will bring more opportunities to the world. This year's two-day forum has attracted more than 110 participants, including leaders from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, top corporate executives, and leading scholars. Multiple multinational executives have explicitly shared plans regarding expanding investment here in the Chinese market. So for more on this, my colleague Zhao Yang earlier spoke with Professor Qu Qiang, fellow of the Belt and Road Research Center with Minzu University of China.
So Professor Qu, Premier Li Qiang in his speech said that despite the global uncertainties, China will continue to inject impetus and stability into the world economic recovery. And he sent a very clear message that China will continue pursuing opening up and improving business environments. So how do you assess China's latest efforts of opening up?
Well, I think China is always a strong supporter and a continuous facilitator of the world economy and global trade. For the 40 years opening up and reform, China has created, I think, a very favorable environment towards international investors and entrepreneurs, especially among the emerging markets. I think China has walked a long way. And I think currently we have been seeing more of the signs and signals sent by the Chinese government to further improve the business environment for not only international investors, but also domestic ones. I think sending out the signals and also the expectation to the world that China is going to embrace the opening up policy and embrace the diversity and also be more open to all kinds of improvement in the businesses. China currently have more than 20% of the GDP created by the international trade and all kinds of the services. Well, you probably say, this is not that much. Right, yes. I think GDP-wise, global trade and investment is important, but not as a strong pillar as before. But China fully understand what's really matters is not only the numbers of GDP, it's the global standard, international reach, and also the best practices all around the world. And only by inviting in the global entrepreneurs, businesses, practitioners into China so they can bring in more of the important knowledges, cultures, technologies, so we can enrich and solidify these soil of the businesses in China. So I think that is the ultimate reason that China, from the top and also to the grassroots level, everybody are talking about how we can open up even further to welcome the international entrepreneurs and the businesses coming into China. And you can expect more of the policies to come in the next 1 or 2 years. And according to my knowledge, many of these policies from the details and also from the overarching designs are already in the making.
And you mentioned that China has recently released new measures to further expand the market access and boost the foreign investment. And China also released negative list for the cross-border services trade. It will systematically open up sectors such as telecommunications and healthcare. So what kind of new opportunities will all these new measures provide for foreign investors?
Well, I think there are three aspects that the foreign investors can really look into. Number one is, like you mentioned, China has built a very clear black and white list for the market entry threshold. Usually for emerging markets, they always, you know, have the black and white list to let the international players know which area they can come in into, which area they can come in into with, you know, certain conditions, and which one they are not to enter alone. So China currently has lowered the threshold for many industries, for example, telecommunication, financial investment. You know, Standard Chartered just established that there are fully funded, you know, financial companies in China, as well as for the manufacturing. Right now in China, 100% of the manufacturing sectors are open to the foreign funds, as well as to the publishing services and technology, R&D, and etc. So I think China really opened up really wide to many foreign investors. So many areas you want to come in, but you can't, you know, previously, but now you have the opportunity to enter and enter, you know, by yourself. And I think second one is a service sector. Service sector was not quite a hot word in China because China used to be a low-income nation or a middle-income nation, you know, previously. But now China is just one step away from, you know, getting into the threshold of the high-income economy. So every economy, when they just entered the high-income economy, there is always a shift in their economic structure, which is the service sector will be more than 50% of their GDP, and more of the people will enter service sector, you know, to get a job. So China currently, especially from the 2023 and also this year, 2024, we see there are a booming or overheating phenomenon in the service sectors, tourism, culture, financial services, education, and etc. So many new business opportunities and new companies are occurring, you know, mushrooming. So I think there are more we can expect in this area, and especially for the international investors in the matured economy, service industry is always their very strong suit. So when they come into China, I think they will have extra opportunities to look into. And I think third one is technologies. So the top-notch technology is what China is after. So China opens really up to the international players, and Chinese government are providing the citizen treatment for the foreign investors and the researchers, inviting them in, providing them the similar subsidies, similar stimulus packages for them to, you know, stay in China and started their practice. And so they can base in China and face the international operation and build their presence all over the world. So I think this three area in the future, international investors can really look into.
And there are a lot of discussions on the forum. All this agenda set on the forum reflects, you know, Chinese government's policy priorities. For example, the carbon neutrality, artificial intelligence, healthcare, and digital transformation. So how important are these sectors for China's economy? And what can the foreign companies look for in China to achieve some, you know, mutual benefits?
Well, everybody knows if a country really wants to, you know, march towards the successful targets or, you know, become a matured economy, they always have to, you know, fight forward, you know, face the difficulties. Economy is very turbulent. So every 20 years, we will have one of the small cycle. So if you remember, 20 years ago, we're talking about 3G internet. So any country who mastered the technology and gained the profit from that industry right now will have a very strong e-commerce will have a very strong digital infrastructure. So you have to, you know, build upon your success one letter upon another. So this is very important. So right now we can see that the new opportunities and new technologies has already been showing up. Carbon neutrality, environmental protection, AI, healthcare industry, digital transformation, green economy, and these are the future. If China can grab this opportunity and stand on this ladder, and then we will march towards another commanding height. But if we miss these opportunities, it's like 20 years ago in your country, you do not have your own 3G technology, if you don't have your own smartphone technology, and then in the next 20 years, you probably will be left behind. China and 1.4 billion people wouldn't want to be left behind. And also when China catch this opportunity, we will also create a very big consumption market. This is not only going to be an opportunity for China itself, but also it's going to be an opportunity for the international market.
Recently, Standard Chartered Securities commenced operations, establishing itself as the first wholly foreign-owned securities company on the Chinese mainland. So, Professor Zhu, how does this reflect China's financial market opening up to foreign capital?
Well, financial opening up is always a very luxury, you know, privilege for the emerging markets, because they usually be only privilege for the matured markets, financial centers. So only when a country or when the economic, zone have fully been prepared in the policy, in the regulation, in the market depths, in also the market structure, as well as the product of the finance. When you get all fully prepared, you can open up. China, you know, in a very long time before, have already opened up its current account, which means we allow free flow of our trade and the products. But for the capital account, we've only been half liberalized. And by these measures, we've been seeing China, on one hand, are marching towards a fully liberalized, you know, capital account step by step. But also, on the other hand, we try to catch up with the market opening towards international investors, which means China has already been preparing itself in the policy, in the regulation, in the government services, as well as in the market building. Mm-hmm. So in the future, I think the ultimate target is that a fully liberalized market towards all the international investors, but with matured government services, very matured regulation policies, as well as all kinds of the market structures and the products and the services in the financial sector.
And we've seen Apple CEO Tim Cook is here to attend the China Development Forum. And let's talk about Apple's increased investment in China, including the opening of a Shanghai new Apple store. So does it reflect the improvement in the foreign investors' confidence in the country?
Well, I think this is absolutely a good sign for the international investors and their view and expectation in China. Well, this year, I think, is just 1 year after the fully opening up of the Chinese economy. And I think many things have already seen, you know, a good recovery. For example, we've been seeing Apple again, you know, become the number one most popular brand in the Chinese smartphone market. I think Apple right now accounted for more than 24% of the Chinese market share by single brand. It's more than Huawei, it's more than Vivo and Oppo. These are Chinese successful players. So I think this shows China with 1.4 billion population, you know, growing middle income, you know, class, has become more and more important in the world market towards the international entrepreneurs and businesses. So I think you really wouldn't want to miss this opportunities to, you know, provide services and products to this large team of the consumers. And also more than that, I think Tim Cook also mentioned, and other, you know, international entrepreneurs like AstraZeneca CEO, they all mentioned, you know, having China as part of their global portfolio in not only the market share, but also in the R&D, in also the capacity building is very important, because China is very peaceful and a neutral, you know, existence in the current turbulent world backdrop.
That was Professor Qu Qiang, fellow of the Belt and Road Research Center with Minzu University of China. You are listening to World Today. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. Former Taiwan leader Ma Ying-jeou will make a second trip to the Chinese mainland next month, leading a delegation of students on an 11-day trip. Apart from Beijing, Ma is also visiting the southern province of Guangdong and the northwestern province of Shanxi. The Taiwan-based Ma Ying-jeou Foundation said on Monday that Ma is scheduled to go through some historical sites, visit companies, and conduct student exchanges at Peking University and Sun Yat-sen University. The Taiwan Affairs Office with China State Council on Monday welcomed this very trip. So joining us now on the line is Dr. Liu Kuang-yu from the Institute of Taiwan Studies, Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. So thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Liu. Now, first of all, why do you think Ma Ying-jeou has decided to make a second trip following his trip to the mainland last year? Actually, Ma Ying-jeou Foundation Director Xiao Xuchen says last year's visit generated a very positive impact on the cross-strait relations. Would you agree?
Yes. Ma Ying-jeou's second visit to Chinese mainland straits illustrates the fact that his first visit last year was very successful and produced a significant positive political and social benefit from on both sides of Taiwan Straits. So this is actually highly recognized both sides of the Straits, and I personally also have very positive observations. Therefore, I believe that Mr. Ma Ying-jeou's initiative to promote this visit this year can help continue and carry forward the positive impact of his last visit. And also we see the timing of this visit, which coincides with the traditional Chinese festival Qingming, I think will help promote the hope that the compatriots of both sides of the Taiwan Straits will jointly pass on and carry forward excellent traditional Chinese culture of paying our tributes to our common ancestors, as well as promote exchanges and cooperation in various fields on both sides of the Straits, including cross-strait used exchanges. And we also see that during his last visit to the Chinese mainland, Ma Ying-jeou emphasized that people on both sides of the Straits belong to the same Chinese nation and all descendants of the Yellow Emperor. He deeply hoped that the two sides of the Straits will work together to pursue peace and avoid war. So as a matter of fact, what Taiwan independence forces right now, they want most is to cut off the common emotions and memories between the people on the Taiwan island and people on the Chinese mainland. So the Ma Ying-jeou's visit this time is a strong reminder that both sides of Taiwan Strait belong to the same China and we are all Chinese.
So one difference between last year's trip and this upcoming trip is that this time around, Mr. Ma Ying-jeou will come to Beijing. So do you have any reading or interpretation in this regard?
Yes, this visit has an additional stop in Beijing compared to last year's, and the political implications have attracted more attention, naturally. We see that Ma Ying-jeou decided to visit the Chinese mainland again for, actually, I think, majorly two main reasons. First, Lai Ching-te of the DPP party will be inaugurated as president in May, and Ma believes that the Lai's stance on Taiwan independence may affect cross-strait relations. And second, the conflict in the Jinsha Sea area has not been resolved and the cross-strait amity is rising. So Ma hopes to melt the ice on both sides of the Taiwan Straits. Actually, at present, the DPP continues to their rule in Taiwan, and Lai Ching-te is likely to implement so-called substantive Taiwan independence and dragging cross-strait relations into a sort of abyss. So the mainland and also the mainland ship collision case, the consultation is inconclusive, and the DPP's cold-blooded treatment is triggering new crisis on both sides of the strait. So in this context, Ma Ying-jeou hopes to visit the mainland for cross-strait relations, I think to pave the bridge to reduce risk, the risk of tension and inject peace energy. And also the Kuomintang, they also said that the mainstream public opinion in Taiwan is to avoid war. Up to 60% of the public opinion against the DPP to remain that power, to resume that power. And Ma Ying-jeou hopes to take this practical action to reduce cross-strait hostility and in cross-strait situation tensions, and DPP has no cross-strait dialogue channel. So this trip is important source of peace to avoid war and to seek peace. I think it's not only in line with interests of the Taiwanese people, but also a common risk of two sides and a positive signal for cross-strait relations and world peace. Also, the media and from Taiwan, they also expecting that Ma Ying-jeou can meet a very high Chinese leader in Beijing this time. And they will value this political influence very, very much.
Okay. So regarding youth exchange or student exchange between the two sides, to what extent do you think the younger generation in Taiwan today need to have a better understanding of the Chinese mainland, and also regarding Ma Ying-jeou's plan, for example, to lead his delegation this time to some historical sites on the Chinese mainland? What do you think could be the problems if there is a lack of understanding about China's history among Taiwan's younger generation?
Yes, we see that first, on the whole, the Taiwan's young generation is not the same as their predecessors. They are not either like generation of so-called outsiders in Taiwan and their children who came to Taiwan 70 years ago and left very old, tattered, and narrow memories of Chinese mainland, nor do they like the so-called natural independence generation, which has almost no understanding and exchanges to the mainland with the mainland at all. Actually, this generation, they live on the cognitive cocoon of anti-China on the island, and they may never been to the mainland. But on the other hand, the close economic, social, and cultural links between the two sides of the Straits have made it impossible for them to detach themselves from the influence of the mainland. So, for example, through TikTok, through Xiaohongshu, etc., they can briefly understand the development and current situation of Chinese mainland in recent years. And therefore, this sort of a direct communication is very essential, very necessary, which can help deepen their correct intuitive view of the mainland, and can also to help break the island's longstanding anti-China hatred under political lies. And just like a recent visit to the mainland by one Taiwan's Green Camp influencer, net influencer, a draft shift in perception, I think, will also change. We believe that this visit will help more young Taiwanese, more youth to realize who we are, where we came from, and where we are going. And we all know the DPP authorities and the pro-independence forces on the island have continued to tamper with the island's history and cultural textbooks, as well as advocating the historical view of Taiwan independence on the island. It's now very difficult for young students in Taiwan to come into contact with the true historical facts of the Chinese mainland and Taiwan. So as that saying goes, to extinguish a country or nation, one must first destroy its history. So if one falls into the trap of lies on the issue of history, it will directly affect the national identity as well as the political inclination of Taiwan's youth. So this is the soil of social consciousness of and concepts in which Taiwan independence has grown over the past period of time.
Ma Ying-jeou remains a senior member of the Kuomintang. So do you think his visit to the Chinese mainland will somehow provide an excuse for those pro-independence forces in Taiwan to politically attack Kuomintang?
Yeah, this is inevitable, and this actually has already happened. Although Ma Ying-jeou does not hold a major position in the KMT now and is not subject to some sort of the island's regulations and can travel freely to and from the Chinese mainland, his political identity and status is still very special in Taiwan, and his moves in some way still touches the sensitive political nerves of the island. So we can see the DPP's attack on Ma Ying-jeou actually is not aiming at him, at himself personally, aiming at him, but also to trying to change the subject to draw the KMT as a whole into the antagonism of the anti-China and political criticism campaign, and to use this as excuse to launch a political attack on KMT to divert contradictions of DPP authorities' recent sabotage of cross relations and ineffective governance, and to provide some sort of cover for the ascension to power of Lai Ching-te in May.
Thank you very much. That was Dr. Liu Kuang-yu from the Institute of Taiwan Studies, Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. You are listening to World Today. We'll be back. You're listening to World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. A United Nations Security Council resolution proposed by the United States calling for a ceasefire tied to the release of hostages in Gaza has failed to pass. Zhang Jun, China's ambassador to the UN, said on Friday that the draft resolution is unacceptable because it was unbalanced and would essentially greenlight more killings. China was among three Security Council members that voted against the U.S. plan. Ambassador Zhang Jun said the draft resolution sets preconditions instead of urging immediate ceasefire. The ambassador also rejected accusations by the U.S. and Britain against China's voting position. So joining us now in the studio is my colleague Liu Kun, who has been following this very issue. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, Liu Kun, what is really the main content within this draft resolution?
Well, this rejected draft resolution call for a ceasefire in connection with the release of all remaining hostages. Actually, it demands that Hamas and other armed groups immediately grant humanitarian access to all remaining hostages. The draft falls short of demanding an end to the war. The proposal backs the imperative for an immediate and sustained ceasefire to protect civilians on all sides, differing from previous draft resolutions vetoed by United States, which demanded an unconditional ceasefire. That's the real problem here.
Okay. So why do you think, from China's viewpoint, this resolution is somehow unacceptable?
So Ambassador Zhang Jun made remarks after the voting in which he gave three explanations. The first one is that the draft resolution always evaded and also dodged the most essential issue, which is a ceasefire. The final text remains ambiguous and does not call for an immediate ceasefire, nor does it even provide an answer to the question of realizing a ceasefire in short term. This is a clear deviation from the consensus of UN Security Council members, and falls far short of the expectations of the international community. Because Ambassador Zhang Jun said an immediate ceasefire is a fundamental prerequisite for, saving lives, expanding humanitarian access, and so on. On the contrary, this draft, as I said earlier, has set preconditions for a ceasefire, which is no different from actually giving what Ambassador Zhang Jun said, green light to continued killing. The second point he made is that the draft is very unbalanced in many aspects. For example, the draft didn't mention Israel's recent and repeated declaration of an offensive in Rafah. It does not clearly and unequivocally state U.S.'s position or, the U.N.'s position on that. And that, Ambassador said, would send an utterly wrong signal and lead to severe consequences. Well, the final point Ambassador said is that any action taken by the U.N. Security Council should withstand the test of history and the scrutiny of morality and conscience. And Ambassador said that the purposes the principles and also the purposes of the UN Charter in mind, with a strong opposition from the Arab states, regarding this resolution, China, together with Algeria and Russia, have vetoed this draft resolution.
Okay, so I guess some countries like the U.S. or Britain are accusing China of serving as a kind of an obstacle to reaching a ceasefire, but that's really far from the reality on the ground. So if we put aside the position of the Chinese ambassador, Mr. Zhang, What have been the reactions from ambassadors of other countries that have voted on this resolution?
Well, as I already said, this draft received 11 votes in favor and 3 against from Russia, Algeria, and China, and 1 abstention from Guyana. Algeria's ambassador, Amar Benjama, said, you know, after the vote, that the council passed its resolution of the council passed its resolution of late February the 20th, which was proposed by Algeria. Thousands of innocent lives could have been saved. He said that since that U.S. has been circulating this draft over a month ago, Algeria has proposed a reasonable edits to achieve a more balanced and acceptable text. He acknowledged that the U.S. has made some changes, you know, taken some of the proposals by Algeria, but core concerns remain unaddressed. Algeria emphasized, you know, this urgency of an immediate ceasefire to prevent further loss of life, but the draft has fell short of that, and that therefore his country had vetoed it. Russian ambassador also said, now the U.S. has finally recognized the need for a ceasefire, but he also said the U.S. was trying to sell a product to the council by using the word imperative in its resolution. And he said, Vasily Nebenzia said, that's not enough and the council must demand a ceasefire. He said, The U.S. leadership is deliberately misleading the international community, just playing to U.S. voters. So that's the main position from a few of the members that voted on this draft resolution.
Okay. Algeria and Russia, these are all influential players, I would say, on this Gaza issue. So what's really being the role of the United States in the UN system in terms of bringing an immediate ceasefire in Gaza? I'm asking this question because as far as I can remember or as far as I can recall, the United States had kept blocking the UN Security Council, at least, from passing resolutions in this regard until at least last year's December.
It's much more than that, actually. Okay. So the United States has exercised veto power 3 times over ceasefire resolutions in Gaza in the UN system. The first one was October 18th last year. The U.S. struck down a draft resolution called for humanitarian pauses, which U.S. Ambassador to UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield said it did not mention Israel's fight of a right of self-defense. And the second time was on December the 8th last year. The U.S. rejected a version put forward by United Arab Emirates that called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. And then the most recent time is, as I already said earlier, February 20th this year, which was proposed by Algerians that called for an immediate ceasefire, which Thomas Greenfield said would put sensitive negotiations in jeopardy. In fact, the U.S. is coming under increasing pressure from Arab states over its role in the United Nations and its way of dealing with Israel since the war broke out in Gaza. During this recent vote, representatives of Arab group of nations at the UN went to speak to the media outside the Security Council following the vote and said they backed the words of Algeria's ambassador in the chamber earlier.
Okay. So the final question before we let you go, Liu Kun. I mean, of course, the bigger picture is that Israel's military offensive or military operation over there in Gaza is basically nowhere near the finishing line. So what is your observation of the latest situation on the ground?
Well, as I already mentioned earlier, the biggest plan for Israel is that it is determined to launch a ground offensive against Hamas in Rafah. That's Gaza's southernmost city. And that plan has raised a global alarm because of the potential for harm to the hundreds of thousands of civilians living in Rafah. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel cannot achieve its goal of total victory against Hamas without going to Rafah. Well, there are about 1.4 million Palestinians living in this city. Israeli, another thing is that Israeli defense minister and also a separate Israeli delegation are in United States this week because the U.S. government has been pressing Israel not to attack the city of Rafah. Actually, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told American press that such an offensive would be a huge mistake. But things are still not clear at this moment.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was my colleague Liu Kun joining us in our Beijing studio. You are listening to World Today. We'll be back. In South Korea, medical professors are moving to reduce the hours they spend in practice in a widening of a doctor's protests. Some professors even say they plan to resignate. Trainee doctors in the country have been on strikes for more than a month over a government plan to boost medical school admissions. The striking doctors make up for 93% of the trainee workforce. This very industrial action has forced several hospitals in the country to turn back patients or delay procedures. So joining us now on the line is Duncan Bartlett, former BBC correspondent and editor of Asian Affairs magazine. Thank you very much for joining us, Duncan.
Thank you for inviting me onto the program again.
So, in your analysis, what could be the implications when medical professors have officially joined into this protests and strikes?
Well, there's a rather unusual situation in South Korea. If you want to get a cosmetic medical procedure, for example, if you want to have something done to your face as a young woman to make yourself more beautiful, there's no shortage of doctors who will give you cosmetic surgery. Mm. And in fact, it's extremely popular. But if you want to have a serious medical condition treated by a doctor, then you might have to wait rather a long time. And that is because there are less doctors per person in South Korea than there are in the United Kingdom, in the United States, and even China has more doctors per person than in South Korea. So what's been happening is that the government has been saying, we need to train more people. We need to send more people off to medical school so that they can become doctors for the future generations. And this has led to some very severe protests by the people who are already working in the medical profession. The doctors have been on strike, and the latest development now is that the professors at the medical schools are not only going on strike, but are actually beginning to resign. So what we've got here is a confrontation between government policy and the entrenched position of the medical profession.
Okay. So South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has made this plan, or on a bigger picture sense, has made healthcare reforms one of the few signature policy initiatives of his own administration. Previously, he has vowed not to back down in terms of implementing the admission plans for medical schools. But on Sunday, he told his own prime minister to seek some kind of flexible measures, quote unquote, in dealing with the issue of suspending the striking doctors' licenses. So, with that in mind, do you think that was a sign that Yoon Suk-yeol's government is ready to make some specific compromises?
President Yoon has been taking a hardline position on this. He's a conservative politician, and that affects both domestic and foreign policy. He made a statement, it is difficult to justify any circumstances where collective action takes public health and lives hostages and threatens human lives and safety. In other words, he's been extremely critical of the doctors for going on strike, and indeed he's been critical of the professors going on strike. Having said that, you know, he is recognizing that it is causing disruption, and so he would like to see the situation resolved. I don't think, though, from what I can understand, that he's asked the prime minister to step in and say, you go and give them a some sort of compromise deal and see whether we can reach an agreement halfway through. I don't think that's what's on offer at all. They're having some negotiations about it. You know, my expectation is that the prime minister will go to the doctors' leaders and say, we absolutely urgently do need new doctors, and this isn't going to affect you, but we're talking about future generations here. So I think public opinion, actually, and this is an interesting one, public opinion is probably not particularly sympathetic to these striking doctors and medical professors. I think many people in Korea think that they got quite well paid jobs and quite secure jobs. And it's a bit outrageous that they're going on strike. But of course, there will be mixtures of opinion. And, you know, one of the characteristics about South Korea is that there are divided opinions on all kinds of social and political issues. It's a distinct characteristic that there are so many arguments. And traditionally, there have been a lot of strikes in South Korea as a result of that culture, although there have been less strikes than there have been in the past, in recent years.
So, like you mentioned earlier, this is representing the conflicts of two drastically different positions. On one hand, we have the position of the government. Okay, we need more doctors for not only the rural areas, but a total greater demand on medical services that is in part or to a very large degree caused by the country's rapidly aging population. But doctors say during that would compromise the quality of services, and that the government should really focus on improving the pay and working conditions of those trainee doctors as the very first step. So as you look at this, Duncan, what is your biggest takeaway from the strikes regarding, say, South Korea's overall socio-political situation?
Well, I think you put your finger on a very important point there, which is that South Korea has a rapidly aging population. And this is a characteristic of all East Asian countries, South Korea, Japan, and China, actually. And this means that the pressure on the medical services is likely to increase as people get older. And also, of course, it raises the question as to how we will pay for people's medical care, because if we have a lower working age population and there's perhaps a fall in productivity as well, then that makes it more challenging to pay for people to take these expensive medical degrees. So I think this isn't just a question that's really facing South Korea, but actually it's raising some questions that need to be considered by local and national governments right across East Asia.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this topic, but hopefully in the foreseeable future, we're going to have more time to have a meaningful conversation with you, Duncan, on this particular issue. But we have been speaking with Duncan Bartlett, former BBC correspondent and editor of Asian Affairs magazine. That's all the time for this edition of World Today. A quick recap of today's headline news. China vows to treat foreign companies equally amid industrial upgrade push. U.S. call for a Gaza ceasefire runs into Russia-China veto at the United Nations. And South Korea doctors' protests are widening as medical professors join protests. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Ding Hun in Beijing. Thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.